coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and Merry Christmas Eve. I hope everybody is out having a great evening with their families, having a great evening by the fire with Christmas, all that kind of good stuff. Hopefully Krampus will not be coming down the chimney for anybody tonight. We have a great evening of guests. We are so happy to be joined in the second part here. Let me see, because we have... John Eric Ege will be joining us. We'll be talking about UFOs, UAPs here in Texas, about not only the drone flaps going on across the country, but also the drone flaps going on here in Texas and the sightings that have happened in the DFW area with American Airline pilots, things like that. In the first segment, we are going to be joined by one of the progenitors of the UnX network, Margie K, as well as Violet Wisdom, who is one of the writers on the network. They have put out a brand new book, How to Research a Haunted House. And this one goes right to the quick for me as far as books that you should own if you are into the world of paranormal. It is really a good outlay on how to go about doing this stuff, on how to go about getting the background details, because all too often we hear stories about places, things like that, but that's all that we know. And is that how you should properly go about researching a property? So welcome to the show, Margie and Violet. How are you ladies doing today?
Great to be with you.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much. And, you know, once again, this is a great book. I love it. I got this yesterday and have had a chance to read about halfway through it. And it's awesome. It's very well put together. And it's one of those, one of the things that I'm very much about, especially with founding Curious Research, is research, data, things like that. Even the idea of whenever you're, and we've talked about it before on the show, Margie, the idea of whenever you're going to research a property, you know, should you be reading stories about that property? Should you be asking people on social media like, hey, what were your experiences here? Or does that color the data? You know, but in addition, not just the rumors that you've heard of something, but, you know, the idea of a disclosure state and a full disclosure state, like, do you live in one? Can you find out the information in a house, whether you're going to even rent a house like I do, or whether you're going to buy a house? Because frequently, if you're going to buy a property in many states in the union, you can find out nothing. Like, it's not a matter of public record as to whether or not somebody committed suicide in the house, or if there was like a Lizzie Borden style axe murder. Like, maybe there were some newspaper articles, but beyond that, it doesn't have to be in any mortgage disclosure or anything like that in a lot of states.
Absolutely correct.
Margie, let's start. How did you guys first meet? How did you guys begin writing this book together?
Well, Violet and I have known each other for quite some time. And in fact, I'm not even sure how we met.
I do. I remember.
Maybe you remember?
I remember we met at a historic preservation event up in North Kansas City 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so since then we've done a lot of things. I bought the haunted Ginger Rogers house in Independence.
Oh, wow.
And owned that for some time until COVID hit, and I had to sell it. But we turned it into a museum, and Violet actually was the manager for that museum. And now, you know, she works for me for the UnX Network. And one day I thought, you know, I really need to create a book on how to research. And she was my go-to person because she used to own a research company. And
oh, wow.
She's done over 50 books that she did historic research on. And so I thought, you know, she's the top person, and we should collaborate on a book. And so I discussed it with her. It was about a year ago. And then we started working on it then right away. And then just recently got it finished. And I think it's, we've done some research on this type of thing. There isn't anything out there like it. So it's a one of a kind book. And so our ranking was right away, as soon as we published on Amazon, the rankings went way up because it's so unusual.
Well, and it's one of those, I don't think that there is another book in the genre of paranormal that should be purchased by your average realtor. I would say this needs to be like listed. You guys need to get a booth at like the Keller Williams show, stuff like that. Not even joking, because the idea of being able to deep dive into what happens on a property, being able to research that, being able to do a full research of that is very important in many cases.
It's incredibly important. And that's something that's kind of an issue right now with a really fast market. There's not a lot of homes for sale. And so when one does go on the market, things have changed so much in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
They're not sitting on the market for 3 months. They're not sitting on the market for 3 days. You know, they'll put them on the market as a coming soon, so that everyone can get prepared to make their offers when it actually goes live. And so no one really has the time to do this kind of research between the time it goes up for sale and gets purchased. So it's really kind of going to be on the homeowner to have guidance to do any kind of research, because the real estate agents just don't have the time.
Well, and frequently, nor the resources, you know, because
the resources and know-how.
Because once again, you've got to go into a deep dive into public records to get this stuff. You know, it's not like it's in some states there is what's called full disclosure, where somebody selling a home has to disclose if there has been a death in the home. They may not have to disclose what kind of death, or, you know, like suicide, murder, anything like that. But how did you guys begin researching the research into this? How did you begin finding out? Because it's a massive amount. And it's one of those, as far as even being a paranormal researcher, I think it's important to understand many of these processes and steps, because it's how you actively go through and validate the story and the provenance of a location before you even, it's no different than doing the research as a MUFON field investigator before something gets turned over to a person going on location, you know?
Yeah. For me, I created, as in detail possible, how I do research. So when I research a property, which I've been doing that for 15 years, then this is how I research that property. A lot of what I do is not online. You can't go to Google and just type in your address and expect to get all of the information on that house. And so when you do try to dig into some of the more difficult things to find, real often you'll have something that pops up where you can pay them some money and access a record. And most of that can be done for free. So I thought that was, you know, that was another thing that readers needed to know, homeowners needed to know, that you can do this. And like you said, these are actual like physical documents, microfilm that exist in a library or a county office. And so I just took them through the exact process that I personally use to research a property. And then Margie did the same thing on her end.
Wow. And that is absolutely awesome, because once again, the research in this book, it's interesting, because it's research in how to research, which is a fascinating topic to begin with. I recently put out a field observation manual for paranormal researchers and things like that in the field. And it blew my mind that even trying to go and find a generalized lab journal, Violet, as a researcher, you know, like, oh, hey, I work in a phlebotomy lab. here's a generalized form. Here's a generalized lab book. Like, they don't exist. They don't exist. So it's like, wow. It blew my mind that all of this data had never been culled together and that this book had never been done. And it kind of blew my mind once again that this research and this data had never been culled together in this kind of way.
Yeah, but the impetus actually for the book was a haunted house that I lived in as a teenager. And we had so many things happen in that house that we use that as an example in the book. So I gave Violet the information that I had, the rumors and the information that I had gotten from neighbors at the time I lived there, and of course my experiences, and then and the address, and I gave it to her and I said, you know, you do the research on this, and then, you know, it'd be excellent for to show people how to research a real house that is still haunted today, by the way. I keep going by there to check it. Oh, yeah, it is. It's one of the most haunted in, I would say, in the U.S. It's up there in the top 10 for haunted sites. Unfortunately, it's a private residence, and they keep trying to rent it out. But every time I go by, it's vacant. And, you know, obviously the reasons why is because it's so haunted. It's like a movie. So haunted. So and then as a paranormal investigator, I thought, you know, my part of the book needs to be that. It needs to be the paranormal investigations. How do you determine who's doing the haunting, why they're haunting, if indeed the house is haunted at all? There are things that can happen in a house that might make you think that there's something going on, like air in plumbing pipes or vents, making noises, expanding, contracting, things like that. So I go through all the mundane things, and then take it from there. So yeah, it's so we have two different chapters basically.
Well,
Violet did the first half of the book, and I did the second half.
Well, let's begin, because of course, either way, whether you're going to sell a house or rent a house or buy a house, or whether you're going to investigate a house for paranormal reasons, it all begins with the story, you know, Violet, let's begin on the research in the hard data research end, and then we'll move over to Margie and get into the paranormal research end of this book. So beginning at the beginning, how do you start researching a property and the history of it, Violet?
It's really, it's like being a sleuth, and it can be really fun, honestly. It can be time consuming because you will go down fun rabbit holes. You start with what you know. You write down everything you know, even the things that may seem somewhat insignificant. So keep a note of those. And that's going to help start you in that process of collecting information. And then it's not just enough to collect information. No, you want to try to verify as much information as you can. So, like, it has been brought up a rumor about the house. So take Margie's house, for example. There was a rumor about a dentist that lived near her house. And that was a great place to start because clues about the houses nearby are also helpful. So now you have a story. Do you have a name? You take a name. These are vital statistics, right? And you can go to the county records and you can match that name to ownership. You can go to a city index and you can find that name in the city index for that year. Now you really want to dig into the stories. Now you need to get into newspapers. And there are some newspapers that are digitized. Our new newspaper here, where Margie and I live, it is not digitized. So we have to go to the library and get microfilm and just go reel by reel by reel by reel. That's the kind of work that needs to be done. You have to go to historical societies and pull files and dig through files. And it's really rewarding work. Again, you could spend 3 years researching your property if you're just dabbling in it here and there. I've spent up to a year doing hard research on a few properties that the owners wanted full books on everything that ever happened in their house, everyone that ever lived there.
Wow.
So an entire year of, I would say probably putting at least 5 hours a week into it. So there's that much to find out. So you want to get the basics though. And especially if you have a really specific issue, you want to find out answers to those specific issues. As with Margie's house, we start looking at this dentist, looking for information about a dentist, and find that there was a man that had been arrested in St. Louis for collecting teeth. And he was not a dentist. He was pretending to be a dentist. And he was working on some woman's teeth and broke one. She called the police and they found a vial of teeth in his hotel.
Oh, God. In his hotel. So that's nice.
In his hotel.
Yeah. Where every doctor should be shacked up.
It's exact. Every almost doctor, every pretend doctor. He was not even a doctor. He was a banker. So it was crazy stuff, but it totally verified some of Margie's stories and cleared up some of the stories that were told to her as a girl that weren't exactly correct. And so that's why it's good to do this research. And especially you brought up people that are doing paranormal investigations. If they really want to know what they're dealing with, and I think, Margie and I've talked about this, the paranormal investigator kind of wants to do their own investigation and have that separate from the historic research until they've done that so that they can match that up together.
And much like any remote viewing session or anything like that, you want the viewers to be separate until come time to compare and contrast data. But the idea of even moving over to Margie now, Margie, how does this affect? Because it is one of those things that, especially in the world of para research, when it comes to parapsychological research on site at haunted locations, when it comes to cryptid research, things like that, it's one of those like stories of hot spots abound. That's what drives a lot of people to go research the locations that they go to, is the droves of stories that they hear and things like that. And once again, we've had the conversation about how that can color the scientific data of things. But how do you, as a researcher, wade your way through the flood of stories about a location and begin to find out the truth of it?
Well, when I'm doing a paranormal investigation, of course, the ideal team would be to have a researcher on staff, a psychic, a remote viewer on staff, and that's usually me, and a separate investigator who is unbiased and doesn't know anything about the location in advance. And of course, as a remote viewer, I don't like to know anything either. I just like to have one piece of information to look at it. So I'm not biased about it. But it's difficult to be a paranormal investigator because you don't always get all the facts. And unless you're talking to a direct witness to something that may have happened on a site, most of the time, it's the original people or the original event did not occur to the people who live in the house currently that may be having problems.
Yeah.
And that's where a deep dive by an expert like Violet will help you determine what the problem, how that originated. Was there a murder in the house or nearby? Because sometimes these spirits, as you know, Chris, travel. And they may go from nearby homes, or maybe there was a train wreck right nearby, which, we've got some cases with that. Or even a plane disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I did a UFO case a few years ago where there was UFO sightings and paranormal activity in the house, and the people first thought it was ETs. But then when they did research on the house, they had only purchased about a year prior, they found out that not too long before that, an engine from a plane fell off of a plane and landed in the house and killed the woman living there.
Oh, wow.
And so they told me that, and they said, yeah, it happened right here in the foyer, right where we were standing. So I remote viewed it, and I found that the woman's spirit was still there, and that is what was, you know, she was causing the problem in the house. It wasn't ETs. It wasn't related to the UFO sightings.
Interesting.
Yeah. Bizarre things like that where you've got to dig in and find facts. That's why, you know, in a perfect world, a paranormal team would have a researcher like Violet on hand. But with this book, of course, now investigation teams can use this information to do the work on their own.
Yeah, precisely. Because, you know, number one, one of the things that I speak about regularly, research does not happen in a vacuum. It cannot happen in a vacuum. You've got to have a ride or die. You've got to have somebody like a Violet and a Margie. You've got to have two people that work together that can not only bounce things off each other, but can also double check each other and check each other's work, and that you trust enough that when they say, okay, you know, awesome picture, awesome EVP, whatever, let's start breaking this down, and you can accept their opinion on it, you know, and being able to have somebody that you can especially go through and deep dive research like this with, because it's once again a Herculean effort sometimes when it comes to researching some properties that have been around for 100+ years, things like that.
Yes.
Indeed. And the fun part about it is when you connect the dots, when you research and you find something unique, like we did in this case, when I lived in the home, we had some encounters with a spirit there, and the spirit appeared to my sister first. My sister's name is Alice. And our first encounter was listening to my sister screaming the first night we moved into the house. So we down to her bedroom, and we hadn't put the beds together yet. So our mattresses were on the floor, and we looked in, and of course it's dark, but we thought we saw her lying in the bed with the covers on. And we said, you know, what's going on? Why are you screaming? And her voice came from the closet, and she said, that's not me. And then the covers just slowly went down, and whatever was in her bed left. And so she was kind of haunted by that spirit. And then not long after, she was sitting at her dressing table, and in the mirror, she saw an old woman in her room behind her. And she turned around. She had a black dress on with a high neck collar, old fashioned. She turned around, and it disappeared. And then we had lots of other things happened in the home. I had a vision one night in my dressing table mirror of a woman dressed all in black with a high neck collar and a big black hat with a butcher knife in her hand, stabbing a younger woman dressed all in white in old fashioned clothing, stabbing her. And I mean, that vision was so clear. When Violet was able to do the research, she found that a woman lived in the home in the early 1900s. She was French, and she had a daughter whose name was Alice. And that just connecting those dots, it just explained a little bit why somebody might be there and why she might have been attracted to my sister, you know, who had the same name.
Wow.
And the family.
Wow.
And the family, because she was a seamstress. That's what she did for a living. And Margie's mother is a seamstress. So it just made absolute sense that she felt deeply connected to them. Well, and even just the clothing that she was seen in, it fit with the era of her coming from France.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Taking
the hair may neck stand up.
Taking that into consideration, because especially once you're researching a localized area, We have to remember that, especially in a lot of our areas, suburban, things like that, they were once cottage areas, that kind of stuff. So businesses took place in homes. You didn't go to a storefront to have your dresses hemmed. You went to Mrs. Johnson's house, you know, stuff like that. So understanding the local culture, understanding the history of the town itself, where the outskirts of town used to be, where people went to have shoeing done at, you know, Mr. Johnson's farm, stuff like that, because you may not have had a dedicated blacksmith, but he was the one who had the stuff to get the shoeing done. You know, how do you go about looking all of that up? Because once again, it's a gross amount of data to try to find. And once you start looking at, especially a property's physicality, like I used to help my dad purchase and renew and flip homes, things like that. And we did have one that we did out in Montgomery, Texas, that easily was 1901, something like that. And as we pulled things apart, you could see differences in construction style. You could see where this part was added onto the home in like the 1960s and the difference in the lumber. Once you took, you know, prime fascia board off the wall and things like that that was rotting. So how do you go about identifying those things and how a home itself has changed over time and over periods and how locales have changed over periods?
So, I do have a section in the book on just what you brought up, different materials, different styles of architecture, different use, how to notice those things. Just having some basic understanding of construction over the years. And if you see a house with a concrete block foundation, that concrete block is probably maybe it goes back to around 1920s. We weren't using concrete block until then. Most everything was stone.
Yeah.
That said, that doesn't mean the house on top of it that is sitting on that foundation is the same age, because houses were moved all the time. It was very common to move houses. So you take a home off that was built in the 1800s off of a stone foundation, then you move it in 1930, you're going to put a concrete block foundation underneath it now on its new location. So, yeah, we go into that. Another thing to keep in mind is how a home was used in adaptive ways. So you brought up a home-based business being more common back in the day. Sanitariums were in houses. There was a house I actually nannied at when I was first married, and it was a big, beautiful Queen Anne style. So it was probably built right around 1890, and all the rooms upstairs had sinks in them. And it was just odd. The kids complained of weird things happening in the house, and come to find out the reason there were sinks in every room upstairs is because it was a sanitarium and no one bothered to take the sinks out. So lots of different ways a property can be used. If you can't find that in a city directory, because again, as you said, most cities started off as maybe one square mile.
Yeah.
And now they might be 50 square miles. So they've slowly annexed over the last couple hundred years. If you can't find it in a city index, you might have to go through actual deed recorders records, and those are public. You might have to go in person. You might have to use a great big book that weighs 30 pounds and flip through it, or have the recorder of deeds pull the microphone for you. But you can trace deeds back and find out, you know, who these people are. And the further back you go, the more likely you are going to have a smaller population, so more stories about these people. So there may be mentioned in the church records. They may be in the newspaper.
Yeah.
There's so many different places that things we think in, when we think in terms of how the world works in 2024, what I did last week with my family might be on social media, but it's not in the newspaper. It's not being written down and recorded at a church. We don't do that anymore. Everything is digitized. Well, back then, nothing was obviously digitized, so everything was written down. Journals, letters, all of those things can still exist today in an archive if you know where to look.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those archives are being digitized in this day and age, and it's fascinating to see it. However, like you were saying, there are some archives that are just so large and vast. My good friend Daniel Allen Jones was just telling me about one. He does a lot of research into the Aurora, Texas UFO crash. And he went to a speech at the University of Texas, Arlington, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. And got to meet this guy from Waco, and he was a historian, an archivist, and he started telling him about his work into the Aurora archive. And he just started sending him, he was like, oh, you know, I think I've seen some of that in our archive, and just started sending him stuff. And he was like, unless I met this archivist, I would have never known that there was an entire archive from the Waco Tribune that was donated to the University of Texas Arlington. So they have like 80 years of microfiche. Nice. Of newspapers from this location and from this old defunct newspaper that's no longer around. So a lot of these archives have been shifted. They've been moved. They've been, you know, kind of poltergeisted, so to speak. It's like you moved the headstones, but you didn't move the bodies, you know? And even with that in mind, you know, the idea of we have a very narrow scope of how we view the world around us and even the neighborhoods around us. You know, it was not until the 19-teens, 1920s that home funerals went out of fashion, that the modern funerary movement as we know it and the idea of a parlor in your home, which could have been a funerary parlor or a meeting parlor for a party for Christmas, whatever, became known as the living room. And that we started having funerals in a funeral home instead of in our living room, and a viewing and awake for 3 or 4 days before the funeral so that people could come into town and travel in via carriage to come see a body that took a day and a half, 2 days to come visit. You know, things like that. So the idea of home funerals happening in a lot of homes that date back to the 1910s, 1920s, things like that, extraordinarily common.
Extremely common. And it was not that long ago that there were family cemeteries.
That's right.
On your property.
That's right.
And so the concept of a big cemetery that most people went to is fairly new. Those are some of the first cemeteries out on the East Coast, Massachusetts. I went to one in Concord, and that was considered the first park. It was the concept of taking a piece of land and landscaping it and having a specific use for it was new. So, yeah, just even you might have a graveyard on your property.
Yeah.
Because they were common.
Well, and that's just it. You know, many of the markers then were not made of stone. They were simple wooden crosses. They'd be replaced out of remembrance, things like that, every decade or so. But aside from that, come the age of disrepair, those things disappear rapidly, and mounded dirt becomes flat dirt, and weeds grow over, and things like that. Even going all of a couple years ago, my wife and I, my wife's from the Boston, Massachusetts area, and Salem is one of my favorite towns, one of my favorite histories in the country, in the world. And we were driving around, and it was Mary Proctor. It was her house that is just literally out in the middle of nowhere. We were driving, and I was like, whoa, wait a minute, turn around. I just saw a sign for the Proctor house. I'm like, what's this? Like, I've been kicking around this area for years and never found this. And lo and behold, yeah, you go to the Proctor house, and there's a tiny little farmhouse and everything. And but right in the back, there's a pathway that leads to the family cemetery and that leads to the local cemetery there where she's buried, where other people are buried, all kinds of stuff. But yeah, it's literally right there on the backside of the property. It's not like it's down the road or excluded from the local homes.
Right. Right. Yeah. The no big giant fence and catacombs and the modern knowledge. Well, what a cemetery is. No, there could be a couple gravestones or, you know, in the cases of war or even the migration west, there may have never been a marker.
Yeah.
People died on the way to Oregon and California. People died in battles and they were buried where they lay.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And you know, how does that, especially on the investigation, para-investigation side, Margie, how do things like especially home burial and that kind of stuff come into play when it comes to home investigation? Is that something that a lot of people take into consideration whenever they're looking at investigating a property that goes back 100 years, things like that? The idea that, well, wait a minute. If like five people in this family died, more than likely they had a few funerals going on in this place, you know?
Yeah, they should take that into consideration. And I think that's one of the things that is often overlooked is the property itself or what maybe used to be owned by the original owner. They may have had a lot of land around them and then sold off parcels.
Yeah, that's right.
I know of one case where the current family owns like 10 acres and they originally owned over 100 acres and their neighbors have their family plot on their property. So originally the family plot that belonged to the original homeowners of this home are right next door. And but they do, you know, they keep it up. But in most cases, people might not even be aware that it's there and it's not kept up. We have a case here in Independence, actually my brother's house, where the home itself is very old. It was built in 1910, but it was built on top of a stone foundation where there was an older house there. And it's got a long history in the area. The property was larger at one time, and I remote viewed it, and I said, there is an old cemetery at the house right behind you. There is one there. So they went, I said, you need to go investigate. So they went back there, and they found some old gravestones. And that was the cause of some spirits walking through their house. They were just nearby. They were walking through. They don't pay any attention to the living people. They just see the spirits walk through their home. It's like a very busy highway portal for spirits to walk through their house all the time.
Fascinating.
It's kind of crazy.
Well, and, you know, growing up in Houston, especially having family from the Channel View Crosby area, where I grew up, the property where I grew up was actually probably about 2 miles as the crow flies from the Newport subdivision, which is famous as the location that the movie The Poltergeist was based on, where it wasn't the fact that the graves were left there and just the stones were moved. It was the fact of when they went to build the Newport subdivision, they built it right on the side adjoining a potter's field, an old slave graveyard that had just been lost. It was no longer marked. It had not been marked for years on city plotage or anything like that. And somebody went to go start digging a swimming pool and they started finding bodies that were at potter's field. They weren't in caskets, anything like that. They just started. So like the whole swimming pool scene from Poltergeist is kind of based on reality. Like those guys went to build a swimming pool and just started finding corpses, you know? It is the Newport subdivision is very famously haunted. There was also Hell House or something like it was a John Ritter made for TV movie back in the 80s that was based off of it also about this whole haunted neighborhood. The idea of these things being lost is not lost unto history. There was a case all of I want to say 2012 in the Ukraine, where they started doing excavation for something and ended up finding, once again, a mass grave, and not just like a few bodies. Like, this was a mass grave. It was a hole in the ground with thousands of bodies, hundreds of bodies in it. And they started asking the local people, and everybody was like, I don't know. It ended up being a concentration camp made of local officers that were all killed. And everybody just, this is within our lifetimes, folks. Within our lifetimes, yeah. Collectively, the town decided to forget about it. And the next generation just never knew, because the parents never talked about it anymore. You know, so it happens. It happens where entire graveyards, yeah. Entire fields like that are totally forgotten about and lost. And unless you can do deep dive history, which is what it took them in Newport Subdivision to find out what that was, you know, not just some serial killer that had been dropping bodies in the woods, you know. But it takes a lot of deep dive research to get into that. And it takes, like you were saying, Margie, a lot of research to get through even the rumor of your location, you know, and the fact of like, oh, a crazy dentist lived there. Well, you know, not really a dentist, but a dude who apparently guised himself as a dentist and liked to collect people's teeth, you know?
And the thing is that, people are not reliable witnesses. the thing is, when I lived there, the story going around was there was a dentist that lived in the house. It was two doors down from me, and it was a mansion, and there was a turret there, and they said he hung himself in that house, in that turret, and you could see it in the window. Sometimes you could see his ghost in that window. So, of course, they had all of us kids in the neighborhood worked up about that, and we avoided the house when we were walking down the street and everything. But the truth is, this truth is stranger than fiction. When Violet researched it, she found out that family, the man did kill himself, but not in that house. They owned a different house. That house was built, they were well-off bankers. They built that house as an entertainment place where they would have people come over to visit. Their other home was at a different location. The dentist actually killed himself at a different location, the supposed dentist. He really wasn't a dentist.
Yeah, yeah.
We were told that he had multiple vials filled with teeth, and that the woman he took the tooth out of actually was the mayor's wife. And he took all of her teeth out when he knocked her out. She woke up with no teeth.
What?
That was the story we heard. It wasn't true. but it was still bad enough.
Well, yeah, because I mean, hey, you know, you're having a tooth extracted. There's a difference between that and 23. But
yeah.
Wow. And that's just it. What a story. What a whopper of a story. You know, yeah. And we had a house like that in West Houston, right down the road from where we lived, that we used to go to all the time, you know, and park down at the end of the road and watch it. And the windows were all painted black on the inside, things like that. And, you know, the story was they unpaint the windows and try to sell it, and the windows get repainted, you know, and just all kinds of stories like that. A multiple murder of a family. None of that. It's true. None of it's true. None of it. It was just an old dilapidated house that was at a point of disrepair where, like, ain't nobody buying a house that big as a unique fixer-upper opportunity in that expensive neighborhood. You know, they just happened to keep building this expensive neighborhood around this very old expensive home that, you know, dilapidation took over, and now nobody wants to go buy the very expensive fixer-upper opportunity, you know? That's the fact of it.
Well, now you should jump on that one, Chris.
Yeah, right. Go buy the black window house in West Houston. But I'm sure that there's probably a listener or a friend in West Houston that's shaking their fist at me right now saying that. Like, we used to go hang out. Yeah, we used to go hang out and look at that. And what a vapid waste of time that was. But in all sincerity, it is one of those that many stories are made like this. Many histories are made like this. Many town histories are made like this. And there are a lot of things to those histories. And once you start getting into it, even the rumors that you heard, Margie, were based upon fact. We're based upon utter facts that once again, I mean, even if nobody played the telephone game and just told the facts as are, creepy as hell. Like, you don't have to get any more creepy than a guy pretending to be a dentist, luring people to a hotel room and extracting their teeth to keep them. That's creepy enough.
It's plenty creepy.
Yeah.
It was still satisfying to find that, okay, it wasn't. this has some basis somewhere.
Well, but the thing is, it took two of you to find that out. Margie had heard these things her whole life, and it was your realm of research and the way that you research things, Violet, that really brought a lot of this to light. And it's interesting to see once again that pair up, that idea of two people being able to prongedly approach a problem with different backgrounds and different skill sets, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And Margie's done the same for me. So I have a guest in my house sometimes, and I was able to tell Margie what I know about the history of my property, which we actually built our house. So the history of my property is farming. And then before that, it's Native Americans that were there. And so, Margie was able to figure out quite a bit about our house guest, and he's happy there. He's not a problem. Most of the time, things get a little crazy. He'll break something, but you know, it's all good.
Well, and you know, that does bring up a different aspect, because of course we forget about even the most recent of histories, as we've talked about, but past histories and past cultures and past civilizations that have lived and wandered the property and things like that. The idea of, you know, Native American populations that may have used the area as encampment, things like that. How do you go about researching that, Violet, and how do you go about uncovering that kind of stuff aside from major excavation?
Right. Well, and I did actually do a small dig on my property.
Awesome.
So just for that reason, and collecting things that if you find an arrowhead or spear point, those are artistic creations, and you can match those to certain periods of time certain families, tribes that were making that type of arrowhead. I've got one. I've got one right here on my desk. My husband made it's going to mimic a very specific people's arrowhead, and the material is going to come from a certain region or was traded from another one. So there's a lot of physical clues on the property. Outside of that, it's incredibly difficult. You can go to a local archaeologist that's going to be able to tell you who lived in the area at that time. And you're going to have to rely on local archives, because there are some graveyards. There's a graveyard near my property that is a known, I believe, Osage graveyard.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's pretty difficult, because the problem with, unless you go way, way back, Native Americans, as more and more Europeans came in, whether they were coming in from Canada or they were coming in from the East Coast, they were, you know, pushing people out of where they were living into another. They were just constantly moving, trying to find a place that could be left alone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the communities existed, but as we came in, they moved. So, yeah, it could be one of many.
Yeah, because once again, the spirit or entity that may be in your property may not be one of modern descent. It may not be one that fully occupied the property in that kind of way. It may have been somebody who frequented the area because it was their favorite hunting location or their favorite trapping location, or, you know, maybe it was their favorite tree to sit and nap flint under, you know, something like that. That is a very interesting concept to think about, because once again, it allows us to take the research of a property into a longer time span and really open up that area for anomaly to occur in that kind of way.
Yes.
Now, when it comes to the para-research side of that, Margie, how many locations, have you ever been to locations that you've found the entity in that locale to be in that kind of way, to be from a time before the occupation of that location?
I've done probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 investigations that involved Native Americans who had crossed over quite some time ago. And they had, in 2 cases, they had a reason to be there, and they had been assigned in the spirit world as guardians of those locations.
Oh, interesting.
In one particular case, in a little town called Tightwad, Missouri, there was I went to the site physically to investigate, but also remote viewed it. And I saw a Native American chief who would come every night and dance in a clockwise circle in an area to release negative energy that had been there for a long time based on a war between 2 warring tribes where multiple people died at that location.
That is truly fascinating, the idea that somebody would be continuously tasked in the afterlife to to do something like that, that upon their passing, they would have a sacred duty of continuance. That is a really, really interesting, because I guess that wouldn't necessarily, I mean, maybe it may manifest as a troublesome spirit to somebody, you know, unintentionally. It's not like they're trying to throw things around and break stuff or things like that, but
no, in this case they would just see the spirit walk through their bedroom every night and through their living room and then go back out.
Oh wow.
And he was actually there because of the heavy dark negative energy. It was a portal, and there were the twisted trees and things that were signs that this was indeed a portal, and there was negative energy, and he was keeping it at bay. He was actually helping this family out.
Wow.
By being there. And wow, after I explained that to them, they were fine with it. They never had any negative encounters with this entity, but he was there with a mission, and he did it willingly.
Wow. That is awesome. And what an incredible story. And, you know, with the idea of willingly, we have you guys for about another 8-9 minutes. Let's explore real quick that idea of agency and that idea of permission, specifically any permitting, things like that. Violet, we'll start with you, regarding what kind of permitting or licensing you need to access any kind of these documents, things like that. And then Margie will come back and talk with you about any permits that people may need to acquire, and of course permission, how to go about acquiring permission to perform investigations. So Violet, let's start out with you there.
So there's no licensing when it comes to doing research. What I do like to share with anyone who's considering researching their property is that if you really want to do a good job, you need to talk to a lot of people, and you need to use tact when you do that, because not everyone feels the way
yes.
about a haunted house that we might, that it's not as bad of a thing, or there could be a religious issue with it. So you go to talk to a church, family members, especially,
yeah.
you know, you really want to be tactful in how you ask the questions about the people that had lived in the home, because it can really upset people. People can be
yeah.
sensitive to that. Now, as far as you had brought up university records in the past, some records that are being held by a university, you could have a more difficult time getting access to them without being a student. But you know the right person, or you go through the proper channels, and you can at least get someone to pull those records for you and find out if the information you're looking for even exists there. And if it does, possibly get a hold of it. You just may not be able to do the research yourself. You're not going to be able to access it yourself. County if you're going into a county historical society, something like that, if for you to do your own research, they might want you to have a membership. So for instance, Oregon California Trails Association, they have a fantastic website. They've been uploading journals from people, diaries, journals, primarily journals from when people were going west to California and Oregon. They're great sources of history. They've digitized most of them. There's a lot of cost in that. So some of those you have to have a membership to access.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of like trying to find out business licensing information from the Secretary of State. You have to have a Secretary of State account in order to really deep dive that information past Better Business Bureau or anything like that.
It can be state specific.
That's right.
May be a Texas thing. I know a little bit about Texas licensing. You can't do anything that requires a license without retaking some exams, I understand, when you come to Texas.
That's right.
It's a little easier here in Missouri. So here in Missouri, if you really want to go down the rabbit hole of licensing, you can. You're going to spend all day doing it, but you legally can get in.
Well, and that's just it. And that's one reason why I wanted to ask that is, I want people to understand that most of this research requires absolutely no credential on your end. Absolutely none. It requires, like you said, a good sense of tact, a very good way of being able to express yourself via verbiage, what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it. Often having a historical bent to that and trying to show the history of a property, things like that will be on your side. But once again, you don't need to have any necessarily bona fides in order to go to these associations, in order to go to these archives and ask for information. It's all in how you do it. Yeah. And that's important for folks to understand. Now, granted, that may change via state, city, municipality, what have you. Like you were saying, your freedom of access to that may change. And Margie, when it comes to contacting a property, Violet kind of touched on it at the beginning of hers, but how do you go about, preparing to approach a property? How do you go about preparing to approach somebody to investigate somewhere? Things like that, and securing those permissions to, once again, Texas ain't the place that you want to go roaming around in the woods of a backyard, all right? Not in the dark, Jack. Like, you may be greeted by shotgun real quick. So how do you go about getting those permissions and talking to a landowner and a property owner?
Well, in my cases that I investigate, it's usually the property owner who contacts me. Occasionally, it's a renter. They don't own the property, but they know something's going on. So if you're going to be stepping onto a property, you want to make sure that you've got written permission from the homeowner to do so, to do an investigation. So that can be done by email. You've got something in writing. It's much better if it's a signed contract. So just a real simple signed contract saying you give me permission to come on your property and do research. And then, of course, if you're wanting to do like digging or something like that, and that's a whole nother set of rules involved. You can't just dig. You've got to have the property owner call the utilities.
That's right.
The dig department, whatever that's called in your area, where they come out and flag everything for all the utilities and cable and all that.
Yeah.
So last thing you want to do is get into that mess.
Well, even to make sure that you aren't digging over a property line, you're digging into a city easement,
Right. But if you're if you're taking a sample, a dirt sample or something, that's okay.
Yeah.
You just don't want to be going looking for graves or anything like that. And occasionally what I'll do, if there's a question like that, I will tell the homeowner where to dig. And then it's their responsibility to do that. And I have done that on a couple of occasions where they did find something that was related to the haunting or poltergeist activity in their home, away from the home on their property. And so I will find it by remote viewing and then let them do what they want to do.
Wow. And, you know, once again, just a wealth of information in this book, and so carefully and well put together and thought out what you ladies have done. The fact that, and I'm glad to see more people doing books like this, you know, because it really is the fact of we are burgeoning on shaking hands with science, with our data. And when you're talking about, especially paranormal investigation, things like that, data that goes into the past, the history of a location, things like that are all data that are important to that data set. So knowing how to properly research that, knowing how to get a hold of that is hugely important. So thank you, ladies, for taking the time and the consideration to even put this book together. How to Research a Haunted House is the name of the book. Before we let you guys go, let us know where we can go to keep up with everything that y'all are doing, where they can go to get the book, to contact you for research, and everything about the UnX network.
Well, to contact us, just go to unxnetwork.com, and everything's there. We, you know, our blog, our magazine, the book listings will be on there soon. I think that's under our merch page. And then, of course, the book is on Amazon, and we will be making that into a Kindle book in January. So it'll be available that way, as well as in print. And, of course, our shows and all the information we've gotten and the blogs that Violet write are on unxnetwork.com.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you guys so much. I greatly appreciate the time. Margie, you've been on the show before. Violet, it's great having you on for the first time. I'd love to have you on, much like Margie, again and again, because these topics, I feel, are hugely important to the communities that we work among. The idea of how to go about doing proper research, how to not just, disrespectfully, when you disrespectfully roll onto a property to do your research, you're ruining the chance for proper research for the rest of us. You know, yes. And it's one of those, like,
exactly.
It's kind of like I teach my 7-year-old son when he's like, why is there a stop sign there? And I'm like, well, because somebody tried something that really didn't work out. Now there's a sign there to let everybody know.
That's a good analogy.
That's how we end up with signs that are like slippery when wet, you know, like that didn't work out well for somebody, you know, and unfortunately, yeah, that's how doors get slammed in the face of good researchers, is other people have come onto properties and not been respectful. Other people have come on without permissions, things like that. So books like this that tell you how to go about finding out the data about a property and how to go about contacting a property in the proper chains and things like that. Hugely important. So thank you guys so much for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close out this segment. While you are online checking out everything from the UnX Network and getting your copy of How to Research a Haunted House, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to get all of the episodes. That is where you can go to like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can go to find all of the embedded video channels of our guests right there, including our guest coming up, John Eric Ege. That's where you can find all of our guest videos. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by the new Texas State MUFON director, John Eric Ege. We will be talking about UFOs in Texas, sightings in Texas, the drone flaps going on all across the country in the UK, as well as the sightings at the DFW airport, coming up right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them.
Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. And thank you so much for tuning in, not only this Tuesday, this very special Christmas Eve episode, but every Tuesday. You know, it is guests like you that help us out so much, that help us reach these messages to larger communities. It is also sponsors like True Hemp Science that help us pay bills, help us get out there on other platforms, things like that. So if you are a CBD user like I am, I use CBD for my travel anxiety. I use it daily by recommend from my doctor. Many doctors are starting to recommend it now. Stop on by and check out True Hemp Science. They make an amazing product. Christopher Lynch over there uses a spigeric process, an alchemical process that uses every part of the plant to its capacity, combusts it down, then uses and reuses everything until there is nothing left. So you literally get a full spectrum CBD product with amazing terpene profiles. It's literally the only CBD product I have found that has actual terpenes inside of it and terpene profiles. It is fantastic. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is John Eric Egge. He is the new state director of MUFON here in Texas. We have been having quite a flap of Texas sightings, including American airline pilots that have recently witnessed super bright UFOs over Texas. So welcome to the show for the first time. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You recently had the opportunity to go down to MUFON 596, correct?
Yeah. That was my first time seeing them in person. They've been in correspondence with me since the since I became state director, and we had a little bit of change of leadership here in Texas and even there in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And so I would shout out to Lillian. She's a good leader, and she has a good team with Valletta, George, and Priscilla, and they have a great group. They're very active, and they have the big event coming in, what, May or April? Mm. And that's now an annual event. They're doing great.
Yeah, the Edinburgh UFO Festival has gone on for quite a while. That is, I think, one of the only paranormal conferences in Texas that I don't sponsor or not a part of yet. And it's mainly because it's normally right up against the same time that I'm on the road with a client. So I need to look at those dates this year and see if they line up, because if they do, I would love to be there myself. I've heard it is an amazing event. It's one of the few that is actually sponsored by a city. You know, so it's on a different scale, and it's great. They bring in thousands and thousands of people and have some fantastic presenters. And I want to say this year they have Giorgio Tsouklos, if I'm not mistaken. They have Giorgio Tsouklos coming to speak. So it's one of those, like, I will probably be telling my client I won't be there this year. Just because he's in my backyard, you know. And you also recently had the opportunity to see the Lou Elizondo presentation up there in DFW.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So I spend a little extra money and sat beside him at dinner.
Cool.
And, oh, my God. and I get celebrity fright. And it's not the regular celebrity. It's like Lou Elizondo or Jim Mars, I wouldn't be able to speak in front of Jim, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm wondering if he's analyzing me, because he's probably like, judges people. He's got that background, right? And one of the questions I asked him, like, you know that green light in the book that went through your house? And he says, yeah. And I'm like, do you suppose that could have been another remote viewer looking at you and your family? And he thought about it. He says, what do you know about remote viewing? And I'm like, well, I know the government didn't stop doing it. And he laughed and he says, what makes you think that? And I'm like, why would you stop something that works?
Yeah.
All you have to pay is a salary.
Well, and that's something that we cover remote viewing regularly on my show. I spoke at the remote viewing conference this last year, and it is one of my favorite topics. I'm a remote viewer who's just started his journey. And it's one of those, like, the way I put it is, it's not that they stopped funding it. It's that they put it into the hands of their private contractors.
Yeah.
So it's not like the CIA is doing it anymore in labs. It's that their independent contractors are fully doing it because they know it works.
Right.
So now, they aren't funding it anymore. They're using contractors that do it.
Yeah. And it's so really a game changer in terms of paradigm. Because if it's right, and we can change the future to some degree, that also means the future informs the past as much as the past informs the future. And how much of this great secret since Roswell wasn't about the aliens, but the fact that we have much more power than you think. And there's a collective unconscious that wants to arrive at a certain goal in history. That's the most ideal opportunity for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. No, precisely. And just the idea that, what has been proved by science over the last couple of years with quantum entanglement, things like that, goes directly back to how put-offs work. And to bring this to the world of UFOs real quick, how put-off is even read into the UFO programs, UAP programs, things like that. And it's because as a laser scientist, and this is kind of what I predicated my talk at the IRVA conference about, was the idea that, why did a laser scientist hypothesize this of anybody? And it's the idea that, and his whole paper was, are scientists affecting their experiments when they go home and think about them on a quantum level? Are they burning the apartment down by thinking, did I leave my iron on while I'm in traffic? And did I think that so long and so hard that my iron actively turned on and burned my apartment down?
Yeah.
You know? And that's there for a reason. And it's there because as a laser scientist, it doesn't matter whether you are building a solid state laser, a gas laser, a liquid laser, you have to know how to vibrate that material to an extent that when photons come in, they come out realigned. So you have to know the vibrational materials of matter to a totally different aspect, to the dimensional aspect. And that brings in the world of UFOs, UAPs, because these things, especially when you're talking about something that can travel at the speeds that we're talking about, make right-hand turns, it seems much more that they would be on a dimensional level to me, John, than at least the ones that perform those feats would be much more on a vibrationally dimensional level than on a physicality level right here, hard nuts and bolts technology that we would make. Now, I personally believe that a good 85 to 90% of what we are seeing in the sky that is unidentified is our technology.
I can't see why not. And I would make an argument that, I make this frequently, in the technology world, they suggest that in the next 10 to 12 years, we'll have AI, sentient AI.
Yeah.
And the first person to have sentient AI will be 10 to 10,000 years ahead of anyone who doesn't. The military is 50 to 100 years ahead of civilian tech. They already have it, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah. And even the idea of these small things, and this is what I keep telling people on the show and publicly whenever I speak or whenever I'm in private conversation with people who are like, oh, what's up with all these panels? We aren't getting any new information. And it's like, whoa, hold on. We have had some very specific definitions given in these panels, which are hugely important to the future research of this topic and to the topic and hypothesis of what these things may be. And when you're talking non-human intelligence, that doesn't necessarily mean biological intelligence.
Right.
Non-human intelligence could act all day long be that thing is an AI-controlled drone being sent here from another dimension, another time, another space, what have you. But it may be an artificial intelligence that is controlling it.
Yeah. And those hearings may not be for us, but for the people that are still not on board yet.
That's right.
When I think about AI and remote viewing, Minority Report by Philip K. Dick seems to be a great example. And maybe the AI needs us as much as we need it to advance to this next level, to really use our God-given gifts to do what we need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is one of those that, you know, I was just telling somebody in a message on my way here, that I was talking with, the idea of like people are frightened by AI. It's a huge buzzword, massive buzzword, been out there with things like Skynet and stuff like that for decades, you know? So when you hear nothing but fear of these things for decades, that's all that's drilled in your head is to fear it, you know? And even the dialogue of UFO, alien, when you start looking at those things from the point of 1947, 1950 to now, only when we had, and when I say now, I mean within my lifetime, within the 1980s, things like that, have you started having things like ET, started having things like, you know, maybe aliens ain't so bad. You know, like maybe if they came here, they weren't just here to destroy us or to militarily attack us, you know. But even then, you see how the military treats them in that movie to the point that all of 2012, we saw the re-release of E.T. where they put walkie-talkies in the hands of the government agents instead of shotguns as the kids were going by them. Because, well, when I was a kid in the 80s, it was perfectly cool for the government to come hunt you down with a shotgun if you were a kid that found an alien. But not anymore. We have walkie-talkies now. So even to see that dialogue change, you know, and the idea of how are we dealing with this topic? Is it okay to talk about this topic? Is it okay for American airline pilots to be publicly announcing things? And thankfully, it is now okay, you know, because of these hearings. We do have things like Aero, which may not be fantastic in a lot of its ways. But to have a unified means by which military people can report a sighting and not have a 20-year career hung over their head, you know?
I'd like to see MUFON be the civilian arm of Aero so that we could help. If we had – what we need is a bigger way of getting data into the system, inflating what needs to go up to Aero to the top and mixing out some of this stuff. And we can't trust – apparently we can't trust the journalists or scientists to do it quite yet. Because if you have a 2-week flap of drones or UFOs in New Jersey and you don't have a parade of journalists and scientists with their detection gear out, I don't know what's going to make them happen.
Yeah, precisely, precisely. And it's one of those, like, there have been flaps and flaps of drones going on all over the country. It's pretty fascinating. I've got tons of stories up on the screen right now just about New Jersey. And the drone flaps going on there. And what's interesting is that they are outright saying drone.
Right.
You know, like no doubt about it. And there was the announcement from the U.S. press secretary right after the last hearing that, listen, we have not found any proof of alien life in anything that we've found and anything that we've investigated. We are very careful about not using the word alien. You know, and it was interesting to hear that distinction, to definitely hear that. And then to see all of these flaps happening directly afterward, because once again, as we were talking about pre-show, the fact that in those hearings, you hear that, well, and you hear Lou Elizondo say, yes, I think a lot of this is hidden because they don't want to show our vulnerability. They don't want to show a vulnerability to an enemy. You know, you're broadcasting a vulnerability at that point. And unfortunately, well, that vulnerability was broadcast right then, right there on the internet, publicly admitted that, yes, we have some vulnerabilities over major sites, you know, and suddenly you start seeing drone flaps all over New Jersey near military bases, here in San Antonio near military bases, on the West Coast near military bases, in the UK at airports near military bases, you know? So it's not just us. It's other places in the world near military bases that these, once again, what they are fully calling drones are popping up.
And if you know the UFO story about that, supposedly aliens can look like people and infiltrate us. Well, why wouldn't they also make low tech just to test us?
Well, sure. And you know, there's also the idea of one of my favorite jokes that you see online regularly is, you know, they traveled interstellarly and just forgot to cut off their lights once they got here. You know, that idea of is it a drone? Is it an aircraft? And that's something that that I love MUFON about. The hard research that goes into things, because not only does a sighting come in through a report, and this is something that a lot of people get angry about, John, is that their sighting comes in and it's dismissed. And it's like, no, your sighting wasn't dismissed. Your sighting was proven to be something within the known quantitative. And it's a discussion that we have regularly on this show, despite audience, despite UFO community, paranormal community, cryptid community. There is a want of confirmation married with a confirmation bias that exists. So you've given a picture and you've put a red circle on it. Once we've defined what's in the red circle, well, it being a known quantitative doesn't mean it's useless. That means we've now expanded the scientific field of known quantitative, therefore narrowing the bandwidth of what is unknown.
Right.
So we have to accept the fact that what we have presented as data, number one, we get very caught up with calling something evidence instead of data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in any investigation, something is data until proven to be evidence.
Right.
So that's something that we as submitters need to remember, is that we are submitting data to a data field, to a data set. Now, if that data ends up being known quantitative, we have still fully contributed to the scientific process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've still fully contributed to the known quantitatives and the UFO field that now leave only the anomaly to look at, you know?
Right. Well, as Bob Spearing says, and he said it very well, that we're really looking for patterns. And so your data, whether the field investigator agrees with it or not, is still there. It's never lost. And
that's right.
As we become more sophisticated in our pattern recognition, we can always go back and relook at things and say, well, maybe there is more to this than we first acknowledged.
Absolutely.
Or the jellyfish UFO is particularly brilliant because Bob Spearing did that, and he did a show with Christina Gomez recently that covered what he showed at the symposium. And that jellyfish stuff goes back to like the 1950s, if I recall correctly. And who would have thought if we didn't have this pattern here, people would have said, oh, that's just a cloud. But when you look at it again and you have all this other data, it changes the way you look at it. So,
you know, there was the video that was put out right as that one was released about the fact that it was balloons, all kinds of things. And even, you know, looking at, cause even considering the one that we talk about regularly on the show here is Go Fast, you know,
right.
And the fact of it got all the way to a NASA panel. And it took a NASA panel to do something that myself and my guest Mike Turber said the whole time, is that you've got a forward-looking camera on an airplane showing the speed of the observation platform, the speed of the object, the distance to the object, the distance to the background, And like NASA said, why did it get to this point to figure out that this is a 40-foot object going 40 miles an hour against a very fast-moving background because of the object that's moving? You know, mm-hmm. like all the trigonometry to figure this out is here. Now that we know it's within the world of known quantitative, we can move on to something else. You know, but if we keep rehashing the same data, trying to make it fit into something is where we get into an issue, you know,
sure.
And the idea of investigation, the idea, because yes, going over data sets is hugely important. That is one of the best parts of the scientific method is the wash, rinse, repeat. You know, the mm-hmm. fact of you're supposed to repeat the scientific method now that you've come to a conclusion and you're supposed right. to turn it over to somebody else to start the whole process at the beginning again. Given that data.
Yeah.
And the one thing that we have to remember is that all of that, John, starts with experience. It starts right. with an observation. And whether or not you've chosen to jump on the train of science with your observation, as soon as you've seen something, the science started whether you liked it or not. You
Fair
know?
Enough. I do love science, and I tend to move towards the soft science. I have a master's in counseling. I'm a licensed professional counselor here in Texas.
Awesome.
And I started as a music major. I decided I wanted to get out of that. I jumped to astronomy, and I decided I didn't want to be a teacher. I became an aircraft mechanic. I worked for American Airlines for 24 years, kept going to school. And I love science, and I know for a fact that sometimes even I misperceive things. I got the whole house out looking at Venus one night, and we were sure it was something else because around it we had like a dozen helicopters in a formation looking for someone, and I just connected it to the Venus.
Yeah.
No one else caught it either.
Well, and you know, it's funny because I do a lot of backyard astronomy. I do a lot of backyard mm-hmm. astrophotography. As my audience knows, as I've told you, I've spent 20 something years in the world of audio video editing, audio video recovery, forensic audio video recovery, you know, all kinds of things, photo recovery. So I can tend to spot a lot of what would be CGI, a lot of what would be made to deceive, things like that. Cause I've made a lot of things to deceive in that kind of way when it comes to production for video work. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't released to deceive, but the video that we made was definitely meant to give somebody the impression of something. And the example that I give on the show regularly, here is one that I play all so often, that was taken right here in my backyard in Cedar Park, just north of Austin. Now, if I posted this on a group, this is a flashing orb, black in the middle, very defined ring, flashing colors, looks like undulating things up around the side, everything else. It's moving slowly from the top left of the screen to the bottom right as it moves through the frame, things like that. Now, if I just posted this on a group, John, and said, hey, I recorded this in my backyard last night, I could get a lot of responses. A whole sure. lot of responses and probably a whole lot of confirmatory responses, you know, like, hey, I record things like that all the time. Now, if I play that same video and I give the data of I was in my backyard with my 8-inch telescope, dialing it in, facing the southeast at an azimuth of 35 degrees at this time in April, well, it would be pretty easy to tell then that what you're looking at is the dog star Sirius, that I was trying to focus my telescope. That was the first. Normally, whenever you dial in a telescope, you have to give it 3 star coordinates, you know? So I was dialing in Sirius for the first one and it was unfocused. So that was literally just Sirius moving through the field of the telescope with the Earth's natural rotation at the magnification of the telescope.
Sure.
That's what an unfocused bright object looks like, you know? And that's a pretty common image that you see in the world of UFO UAP.
Sure.
It's a pretty good one and a great example of something that is in the night sky on the regs, that if mm-hmm. you look at it as opposed to the surrounding stars, the nature of that star because of its brightness is to twinkle like that, is to change colors right. like that. So when you're looking at it at the field of other stars around it, it's the only one that's changing color and shifting color like that. And with its brightness and magnitude and with any kind of atmospheric aberration from temperature inversion, things like that, nice hot day moving to a cool night, that kind of sure. stuff, that brighter star will definitely begin to wobble and move against the horizon line against the other dimmer stars that aren't shifting sure. color. You know, so things like that, you know, like you said, even yourself being a field investigator, hey, man, you were entranced by Venus for how long and told everybody to look?
It was a good 30 minutes for watching
yeah.
it. So.
Yeah, no, exactly. And right now, Jupiter is a big one in the night sky. Awesome. It's bigger than it normally is. Right now, it is actively rising for, I want to say, the first time in 30 years as the Christmas star. In the way that it is in the night sky with the luminosity that it is. So it's bigger and brighter than usual.
The one great thing about MUFON, at least the way I see it, is it's not just the individual field investigators.
Yeah.
It's a team.
It is.
And I've gotten really good at like detecting lens flares. But I know for a fact that if I have any doubt, I bring it to the team or the team brings their stuff and we work it out together. And usually – as a team, we will get it so close to being identified that we're confident.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. It's the fact of not only does it go through a rigorous check to begin with, not only do y'all utilize tools that I tell people about regularly, stuff like satellite tracker, flight 24/7, things like that. Yeah. Now, granted, once again, folks, just so you know, flight radar 24/7, satellite tracker, even Stellarium, which is a fantastic one, which shows you satellites in real time. It's not going to show you every satellite. It's not going to show you an NSA observation satellite. All right. That's not going to have a publicly pingable, tracking system, you know, that's going to show up. You aren't going to see a military aircraft. But beyond maybe a C-130, you may see a C-130 or something like that on flight radar 24/7, but you aren't going to see like an F-16.
Right. Well, one of my most successful, it was my first mass write-up. It was a SpaceX and even the news got it wrong because they were saying that we saw the Falcon 9 over Texas. I'm like, no, the Falcon 9, you can't see beyond 600 nautical miles, and it was up and back in 8 minutes. And so that wasn't what we saw. And so what we must have saw was the second stage decoupling from the Starlink packages. And,
yeah,
boy, I'd sure love to speak to a SpaceX engineer and so I could, like, get confirmation to 100%.
Well, yeah, but that's another one that's huge right now, not just the Starlink trains, but also even spotting the return, spotting that moving through the sky and coming down and – the angles at which it can be seen and the spiral return of rocket boosters, things like that. These are
smoke ring is brilliant.
Oh, it's beautifully brilliant. And it's one of those that it's almost a signature too, though, that once you're aware of it, you can pretty well calculate what that is with 98% accuracy just about every time that like, oh, no, that's the Dragon capsule.
I've probably seen 100 videos of that now. People are going, oh, my God, what is it?
Look at this huge jellyfish in the sky, you know, or look at this huge spiral pattern. And it's pretty fascinating. And it all depends on which angle you're looking at it from, you know. And those things, once again, are something that a great vast amount of the populace are not aware of. You know, a great vast amount of the populace, Eric, are not aware of the fact that, yes, there is a secret space program. It's existed for quite a while. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the experimental X-37B over our heads.
I was just thinking that.
That we found out about when it landed from its first mission, which was unmanned for 2 years. It landed in like 2012 from its first successful mission of over a year and a half, almost 2 years over our head without us ever knowing that it launched. So yep. It was up there. It was reflecting signals. It may have been visible in the lower atmosphere, doing all kinds of things, doing braking maneuvers, high speed braking maneuvers now that they're practicing successfully with it, all kinds of things. So this is an unmanned platform that is approximately a third the size of the STS, the shuttle transport system.
I've seen pictures of it.
It is. It's a beautiful piece of machinery. And it's one of those, like, if you aren't a headline chaser, if you aren't somebody who follows a ton of tech, things like that, it's not like they announce it with triumphant horns whenever it comes back from spaceflight. Like, you may see a headline or two, something like that. But what it's doing up there, you'll never know.
We'll never know.
The satellite, even three quarters of the launches with STS, the space shuttle, were classified via DOD, and you will never know. They didn't even know what their mission was till they got into orbit. They were either launching a satellite of unknown origin that they had no idea what it was, or they were repairing a satellite for the NSA or something like that, and ain't nobody telling you what that's about.
That's fair.
There are tons and tons and tons of programs over our heads regularly that we have no idea about. And it's pretty fascinating to know that.
Yeah. And it makes you wonder, with all the stuff that we know that is ours, how do you sort what's ours and what's not, given how much stuff is going on?
Yeah. Yeah, but precisely. And once again, having things like what just happened with the American Airlines pilots, to know that they will keep their wings despite reporting this. It's an amazing thing now. That would not have been the case 5 years ago.
Yeah. Do you remember the 2020 episode where apparently a missile went over – something missile-like went over one of the flights? I think it was going towards Phoenix, Arizona, and the pilots reported it.
Yeah.
We still don't got an answer on what that was.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that's just it. Our pilots are up there regularly and they see all kinds of things. And even the pilots that I know privately have been very, very, very like, no, I won't tell you anything. I'm sorry. They just won't. And it's not like what I'm going to hear is going to get back to United Airlines in any kind of way, shape, or form. You know what I mean? I know nobody at United. I don't go to their parties. but it's interesting to see how tight-lipped they are.
Yeah, I have a pilot friend. He trains American Airlines pilots, and we talk quite frequently whenever a big sighting happens with American Airlines, and we talk about it. I'm fortunate to have the people I have to talk to.
Oh, absolutely.
Real diverse group.
Well, and, let's start getting into some of these recent sightings over Texas, John, and what they might be, what they indicate.
Well, there seems to be some of the New Jersey drones happening here, too. And I don't have this through official MUFON channels yet because they've not uploaded it to the MUFON site. And I do recommend if you guys are seeing things out there, I don't care what it is, make a report. The worst thing that happens is we eliminate some more chatter and we become more skilled at getting rid of chatter. We see Starlink a lot too. I see it flashing on the screen. So north of Dallas, I'm going to keep the city kind of secret because they want me to come up and try to answer what they're seeing. And it looks like they are seeing the same kind of drone activity that New Jersey's seeing. And the videos are pretty close. Until I get more videos and more pictures, I'm not able to make a conclusive picture, but I've got some areas where they were shot and we can kind of try to backwards engineer. But what's interesting is I spoke in Edinburgh at the 1956. On the way back, we funneled through Border Patrol and I got to talking with the Border Patrol agent. And when he discovered I was the MUFON guy, he wanted to know about the drones he's seeing in the area. And a little bit later, as we were driving back, I got pulled over by a state trooper for speeding. And we got to talking about where I was heading, where I was from, and UFOs came up again. And he wanted to know about the drones he's seeing. So I have to wonder if these everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I tell people regularly, number one, there are a growing number of drones out there. A growing number of very, very high technology drones that are available. And there are some that, yeah, are being used. One that I showed somebody the other day in a post was, it's like an $88,000 drone. But it's a massive one. It's big and it's capable of flight times of, you know, 10 hours, stuff like that. So it's not like, you know, when people are like, oh, this thing was hovering there for 3 hours. It's like, yeah, there are drones that can hover for 3 hours. And when you're talking about LIDAR, when you're talking about doing surveying, that kind of stuff, it's becoming more and more common. You know, well, to use that kind of tech.
You should be one of. Sorry, I spoke over you.
No, it's okay, my friend.
You gave me one on the Chinese drone, which is like a mothership for drones. And when I not too long ago, Chris Mellon was speaking on the Good Trouble show, and he was saying that a sheriff in undisclosed location near nuclear missile silos saw a mothership with a lot of smaller ships going to it. So is it that? And if it is the Chinese, what the heck is going on that we're just tolerating these incursions?
Yeah, and this thing is massive, folks. Just so you know, like, I work around these barricades pretty frequently. These barricades are about 15 feet long, 12 feet long. So when you're looking at this thing, that's probably about 15, 20 feet away from that barricade. That is a wingspan of almost 40 feet, man. That is a full size airplane. That is easily the size of a Cessna.
Yeah.
You know, and that is a huge, huge thing that is made to release a good swarm of like 40 drones, you know?
Right.
So once again, seeing these things out there, knowing that they're out there, knowing that there are drones that now move from and winged drones that move from hovered flight to horizontal flight with ease, with almost no downtime in between the two. It's pretty phenomenal to see.
If we allow for a hypothetical conversation, though.
Sure.
I'm bothered by the fact that they keep saying that they're probably our adversary drones. Mm. And how do we allow this to occur over our space? And, you know, we had that big fuss about the spy balloon and that military didn't even know it. And I'd like to think our military does know what's going on. And when we have that UFO group, what is it, the WGA, that can go to any country and recover a UFO without having to get their passports checked. Are we really all in cahoots? And when you see the Space Force symbol that kind of looks like Star Trek, but if you pull up the lunar lander for the Chinese put that rover on the moon, and you look at their little symbol in the icon, it looks like the Starfleet Federation symbol too. Are we really fighting each other, or is there something else at play?
You know, you do have to go through that hypothetical, because one of the things I bring up regularly is up around 2012 was when we got the intergalactic representative at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and I don't know who it is now. At the time, it was a nice lady from South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But we now have a UN intergalactic representative.
Right.
You know, and
Hamish Shedd back in 2018. Yeah, remember Hamish Shedd said there is a Galactic Federation. And why is he using Star Trek language?
Yeah, yeah, and it's fascinating to explore those things, and I love exploring those. We explore them on the show pretty regularly, and it is interesting to see that because once again, yeah, when the Space Force was announced, it was one of those like, yeah, but you've been doing that for a hot ticket minute,
you know? Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what Cheyenne Mountain is, you know, is nothing but Space Force. So, but at the same token, John, we have things like in the last month, we have had no less than 5 asteroids.
Yes.
Three that have passed, 2 that have impacted. And those were not detected until hours before. And that's fascinating mm-hmm. to know that something of that size can be totally untracked. Something of that size can completely approach Earth with without our knowledge until moments before it happens. So literally, it would be the case of, oh my gosh, the movie just left my head, Independence Day.
Yeah.
Where quite literally it's like, hey, look at these things. And then there's a news announcement and it goes, hey, so, we apparently have about 2 hours, just so y'all know.
Yeah.
Like that's how that's going to go down, people. We aren't going to get a whole lot of warning when it's like alien invasion from space or something like that. Well, like if you think they have any kind of cloaking technology or something along those lines, like, yeah. We can't even find an asteroid as it's coming to us and it has zero cloaking. Like that is a big rock frequently made of something like iron, you know? So it's pretty heavy, pretty easy to ping with a sonar or something, but yeah. Nothing.
What about the satellite that took samples of brought back samples from an asteroid and they found Earth bacteria in the sample. Did we take that there? Did we find it there? And there's microbes on the space station. And so
that's right.
There's probably life in space, even if it's just ours.
Well, yeah. And there's somebody that I know on social media who is very, very much about the fact that the aliens are in the ocean, which I don't doubt, you know, because we've definitely explored more of outer space than we have of our own ocean. But their whole reasoning was that, you know, the long chain molecules and amino acids and things like that. I'm like, man, they could get that at any neighboring nebula as they pass through it. Like just throw a net out and seine it while you go through, you know, like there are organic compounds sitting all over the place in star clusters and things like that. So if they're getting any kind of energy from that, they could definitely be swathing that genetic material at the same time, you know, like go belly up against the backside of a comet while you're flying and you could grab tons of water and everything else, you know? So I don't know about that.
You just said something interesting.
What's that?
You said something interesting. And it always occurs to me at the same time when you say it. So like you mentioned that we know more about space than the depths of our ocean. And I would suggest to you, we know more about the depths of our ocean than the depths of our own mind.
True that.
And when you the subconscious is like 95% of our, and our universe is like the visible part is 96 and there's only we only see 44% of the, and so there's that parallel again, same above, same below.
440 nanometers.
Yeah.
Is our visible range.
Yeah.
Amongst the entire electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah.
So pretty minuscule. And that's something even in the last panel, the NASA scientist that was speaking, the former NASA scientist, who's now in the world of private contracting was like, listen, like you want to know why we know so much about quarks and quasars. We have built specific things to study quarks and quasars. The only things we have from this are from known platforms that we use for something totally different. They're infrared cameras and stuff like that. We don't have specialized instrumentation to look for these phenomena specifically. We are using other technology that's used for something totally different. So we wonder why we have almost zero scientific data on it.
Yeah.
Because we don't have anything to gather the data on it. We don't have any specified data gathering platforms for it. You know? And that is something that is just coming to bear now. Now, granted, come the time that we said, let's go to the moon, within a decade, we were on the moon. So considering the flash of technology and the way that things move now and the technology currently available, we could be looking at sensors to monitor these things within the next 5 years. You know, even now there are things like I've got a Madar node in my living room. You know, Madar is a device that basically registers electromagnetic and magnetospheric anomalies in your area. And it's operated off of the same thing as kind of the SETI node concept, where it's like you're using a specified amount of bandwidth on your computer to help SETI decode things. You know, and uncompressed data.
I recommend everyone get that. And I find it also seems to parallel the Global Consciousness Project, yeah, where they were using random number generators look for anomalies based on the fact the random number generator stopped being random during certain events, including UFOs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the first real big hit that they had like that was 9/11.
Yeah.
Was the first one that they recorded where there was just a spike across the globe of the random number generators all coalescing.
Yeah.
And it was just That's weird. Huge. It was like a windfall.
Well, what's interesting about it to me is it happened 15 minutes prior to the event.
Yeah.
All right. Now this will be completely speculative on my part.
It's okay.
But this part here is fact. You can measure a person's ability to make a decision in an fMRI, and the scientists can tell you they can tell you what you're going to decide 80 milliseconds up to 10 whole seconds prior to you're consciously aware that you've decided something.
That's right.
Now, so if that thing with the consciousness 15 minutes before the event happened, and we can also have retro causality with the collapsing the wavefront with this double slit experiment, what if we are having conscious experience in real time, but we're collapsing the wavefront behind us and someone else is observing we collapse the wavefront, but we're all really in real time having our conscious experience just like we all imagine we are, because –
And you know, that is one of the things that brings up my phenomenological issues with stuff like CE5, John.
Mm-hmm.
That is what brings up some of my phenomenological issues with the way that a lot of people do paranormal and even UFO investigation, mm-hmm, where it's like, hey, I'm getting ready to go study this place. Share with me your stories. You've heard of it. It's like, oh, no, no, no. Number one, you're just polishing the lens through which you're going to be looking at all data now. Like, you're literally grinding the lens and honing it with the stories that you've heard before you ever go gather the data. So it's already colored. Yeah. Number two, could you be, once again, looping this conversation back to that quantum idea of Hal Puthoff, mm-hmm, could you be warming the iron before you ever step foot in the room? You know, could you be?
And there's another possibility.
Yeah. Like in a quantum realm, could you be actively manifesting what you're looking at?
And that's what I was going to say. So if you will allow a really interesting storyline,
sure,
I'm going to present three different pathways to do CE5 and get results.
Okay.
The first one will be Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich. You want to do chapter 14, the invisible counselor technique. You follow that technique and you can have real-time experiences with whoever you choose as your counselor, whether it be Einstein or Uhura from Star Trek. All right. There is a TOPA technique, which came from Alexandra David Neal, who wrote the book Mystery and Magic in Tibet. She's the first anthropologist to actually be allowed into Tibet in the 1930s. And they taught her how to make TOPAs, and they told her not to. And she made a Friar Tuck TOPA against their will. And you'd think Friar Tuck would be okay, but he's also a merry man and probably a rascal. And he started harassing the villagers, and the villagers complained, and the monks came and made him dissolve. You also have active imagination with Carl Jung, and the Red Book has Philemon, his spirit guide. And I would say to you that Philemon is to Carl Jung as Loxi is the door of bliss is to me. And she's somebody that I created using topomancy or the invisible counselor technique. And sure, I've had physical experience where I could feel her tapping. I can hear her speak. I can sometimes see her, but usually it's in a meditative state. Well, Philip the Ghost was a scientific experiment where scientists created a fake ghost and mediums tapped into him and got the history of Philip as created by the scientists. And now CE5 has the same protocols and they all kind of mirror each other. And so if you have it in your mind, you're going to have an experience with a certain thing, you might just create that experience.
Well, and exactly, or you may, even on a more dangerous note, invite Captain Howdy in, you know,
in the, or
just as
or
a, just as a fan planet of the movie The Exorcist. That's how that started, was she was just playing around with a Ouija board. No, it's Captain Howdy, you know, because she was perfectly comfortable with meeting that. So that entity firmly used that. Yeah. And that's kind of the dangerous part. If you aren't aware of such things or aren't, I guess, of the ilk to be able to spiritually protect yourself or know the difference between good
or
and transgressive.
Could you say that Forbidden Planet is actually soft disclosure and we need to be a lot more careful?
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's kind of something that we talk about regularly is that idea of soft disclosure, that idea of prepping the conversation, even like we were talking about earlier, the hearings that we have right now are prepping those people. Because, yeah, you know, if you've been in this community for the last 20, 30 years, you're probably not hearing anything new. These are things that have been hypothesized and talked about as fact in the community for years. So for us to hear that there's a recovery program, no, nothing new for us. But for someone like my dad, who's like, oh, what the heck are they talking about little green men up there for, eh? Ain't I paying them for something better? You know, it's new information for them. And if you want to get to the point of an Ollie North up there with his hand up, you know, whether it be through an alphabet agency or a contractor thereof to talk about the reverse engineering programs or Immaculate Constellation and the idea that there are recovery programs. Yeah, there will eventually be a fall guy. And the only way you get there is to find where the purse strings go and then choke them with it. Yeah. That's the only thing you can do. The halls of Congress are a legal means is what they are. That's exactly what they are and what they're meant to be. So we have to find the purse strings that Grush is talking about. We have to find those people because otherwise we will not end up with it being the next Iran-Contra, which is how I explain it to people. You know, it was a big conspiracy theory that the CIA and other people were selling missiles and stuff like that to help drugs and everything else, John. It was a big, big conspiracy theory that Operation Phoenix existed and that we were selling heroin and things like that during the Vietnam War. That was a big conspiracy theory till we had hearings about it and we found out, oh, crap, that's real.
Yeah.
Oh, crap. The whole Gulf of Tonkin was fake.
Yeah.
And on purpose. You know, on purpose fake to bring us into that so that we could sell heroin and make tons of money. Like, that's just disturbing, but it's only through the small, tiny hearings that lead to the big one that we find out about things like the church hearings and that kind of stuff and find out that, no, MK Ultra was real and we really were trying to brainwash people, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the only way you end up there is with these tiny hearings, with the ones that seem very, very insignificant, but that set up the chess pieces on the board so that you can go and find where this stuff goes. And that's where we're at right now. It's very, very exciting, but it's also very tumultuous in these communities because of it. And I think that there has been a lot of wedging and forceful wedging within these communities to cause divide in them as this comes to the front the way it is, you know?
It is a curious piece. I wish it wasn't so. I really love all the people that were before me, and because of the way some of it fell out, I think I've lost contact with some people I held dearly.
And the sad thing is overall, with fallout in this community, all that kind of stuff is they, you know, it doesn't behoove research in the long run. You know, all egos aside, research does not happen in a vacuum. And when you decide to wall off communities, when you decide to uninvite people to community or anything like that, it literally only stymies the research, you know, because we all have to depend on each other. We all have to be there. It can't happen in a vacuum. Eventually, we have to take it to someone else and say, please look at this with your eyes. You know?
Yeah, we need that. We need each other the same way the mass array, a telescope, can see the entire universe. We all have a piece of this, and we all connect verbally or through the collective unconscious, and we share, and we come, the universe comes into resolution through all of us.
Yeah, No, absolutely, man. And I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been, I mean, it's flown by. I love having you on. We've got to have you on again and again, as I said at the beginning, because to me, especially when, even whenever it comes to politics, man, I try to tell people, like, the rock star concept of the American president is great, but please, good God, pay attention to your state and local government, because that's where it really falls. That's what the 10th Amendment is about. As if the federal government didn't say something about it, your local and state probably does.
Yeah.
So pay attention there. It's the same way with these communities. There's a large scale of things that go on even politically behind the scenes with these communities. But the important thing is that localized aspect. The important thing is people like you, John, going all the way to South Texas to talk to that group, coming all the way to San Antonio, things like that. And building those bridges amongst the localized communities, because if we don't have our support locally, then what happens to the investigations locally? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We're a team, and it's got to remain that way.
Absolutely. Now, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get a hold of you, where they can go, because you write on Medium. You did a great article that you shared with me about remote viewing and UFOs, things like that. We've done that quite a few times recently, talking about that. But let everybody know where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to keep up with your research, where they can go to submit their sightings, things like that, to you at MUFON.
Okay. So, in terms of me, if you want, I'm on a couple Facebook groups, Texas UFO Network, and if you like writing, you might not like mine, but I do write every day, and I've gotten better at it. But I will have an occasional rant, like on Medium. You'll find me under John Agee, and the accidental remote viewing might be the greatest. I'm putting together all of these things that look like remote viewing, and I assume if it's real, people who are writer or artists will accidentally create stuff by tapping into some other place and time.
Yeah.
And you'll find that. And there's evidence for that, like Robert Morgenson's book, The Titan, which is a play-by-play book of the sinking of the Titanic with everything but DiCaprio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. And then Poe actually wrote, Edgar Allan Poe wrote this book where it's his only fiction piece where these people survived a shipwreck and there's four people in a life raft. They eat a sea turtle. And the last one, Richard Parker, gets eaten. He's the youngest guy in the group and he drew the wrong straw, I guess. Well, in real life, 40 years later, 46 years later, that boat actually sinks. Four people on a life raft. The guy named Richard Parker dies because the other people eat him. And I'm thinking, my name's Richard Parker. I'm not going on a ship.
Yeah. Yeah. Arthur Gordon Pym.
and there's other things like that. And I line them all up in that piece. I even suggest to you The Face on Mars is a remote viewing thing. Ooh. Because there's a comic book from the 1950s showing The Face on Mars with people going in it and finding an archaeological site. And there's a Japanese artist in 1946 who he thought we were going to blow ourselves up, and he wanted to make this giant monument. And he said the only way to see it would be make it this big so you could see it from Mars. And so he said The Face on Mars, and it's an amazing thing.
Interesting. That is fascinating.
And so if you email me, that's great. I'll answer anybody that sends me an email, solarchariot@gmail.com. And if you have a sighting, please, it's not about me. Let's keep MUFON growing, because it is the only database of its kind, and it really has some great stuff. Project Aquarius is one. Earl Grey, Mr. Anderson there, I love that guy. There's many fine people. Don't let politics get in your way. There's always going to be politics, and there's always going to be people with opinions, and sometimes we're going to be frustrating, and even I can be stupid and angry. And
that's right.
I emote, right? But most of the time, most people are good people.
That's right.
And we're just trying to do the right thing.
Absolutely. And John, thank you so much. I cannot wait to have you on again and again and again to talk about MUFON here in Texas, talk about sightings here in Texas. I'm so excited about this. Thank you so much for everything that you have done since coming aboard as state director. I have been seeing some great things online and hearing some good stuff. And thank you so much for everything that you will do for MUFON here in Texas as well.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Stay with us real quick as we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from John Egge and MUFON, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find the embedded YouTube channels of all of our guests as well. That is where you can find that right there on curiousrealm.com/videos, folks. You can also find all of the amazing events that we sponsor there. You can also get your copy of the official Curious Research Field and Observation Log if you are a paranormal investigator, cryptid investigator, UFO, UAP field investigator. Stop on by and check this out. It is your one stop as a data collection journal. So while you're out in the field, gather that data while you can, write it down while it's fresh so that you can have it ready to shake hands with science. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.